Coming up on this week's show, a long-lost Mario 64 secret is revealed.
The ultimate add-on for your Commodore 8-bit.
And we get the story of the Atari 2600 Plus with its creator, Ben Jones.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every week with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. Now, why don't you treat yourself to this? Have you seen The Art of the Box? Now, with more than 80,000 words and 350 full-color images and covering 26 different artists, this is a glorious celebration of video game box art. As told by the people who created the covers with the paint, the ink, the pens and the airbrushes. You can find out more about that, check that book out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our lovely mates at PCBWay. Now, of course, you know about them. They offer a fully featured custom PCB prototyping service with low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards. And if you want services like 3D printing and injection molding, they've got you covered as well. And of course, you know that PCBWay are big supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 410, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast, not only the show that, of course, brings you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro gaming and technology news, but can we just say a very happy new year, the first podcast of 2024.
Oh man, 2024, it's the future, guys.
See, do you say 2024 or 2024? I was having this debate with someone the other day.
It's a good question. I think
I say 2024. Yeah. It does sound futuristic, and it's kind of like when you were a kid and you said 2024, it'd be like jetpacks and, you know, kind of all this madness. But no, there's no jetpacks here, is.
Well, as we do enter a new year, we're not going to go too big on this, but I just thought it might be worth pointing out to you guys that this is actually our 8th birthday of the podcast as well. You might remember, ooh, we started the show all the way back in the first Friday of 2016, so that means 8 years that we've been doing this every single week. And I don't know about you guys, but I always feel pumped up at the start of a new year as well. You know, lots of possibilities, lots of incredible guests to come, all the events that we're now going to be going to throughout the summer as well, as we kind of leave the Christmas period and new year behind us as well. Just to, you guys have good Christmases, you know, you're feeling refreshed now.
I went and saw lots of different friends, loads of people haven't seen. I've probably been out more than I've been out in the whole year in 1 month. And I've probably ate more than I've, had in the whole year in 1 month as well.
Mine was an interesting one. I managed to get like 9 days off work. But as you guys know, and maybe many of our listeners know, our book arrived just before Christmas. So I pretty much spent the entirety of my time off packing the book. Wrapping them all up.
Yeah, Joe's house basically turned into a warehouse, didn't it?
It did.
For the Christmas period, And you did a fabulous job as well. Thanks to Charlie as well, because your wife did a great job in making sure that they were packed in a very nice way.
She did. She helped a lot. And then Dan came over for, I think, 3 days on the trot as well. And Dan was our superstar delivery man.
driving through puddles, floods, storms.
Yeah,
because you guys are out in the countryside, and it has been storming a lot. I even remember when I was driving to Joe's to get the books, like bridges were getting shut down, and there was like flooding going on. I was like, right, I've got to avoid that one, and I was driving through a storm. Yeah, it's been been pretty chaotic.
I mean, we could have been sensible. We could have got the books delivered like in August or something, but that wouldn't be us, would it?
That wouldn't be us. No,
before
no.
Christmas.
As soon as they were done, we got them delivered. And but I am very, very, very happy to report that they have all been posted as of today. As of the point of recording, all of them have been wrapped and posted out. And they have been arriving in people's hands the last couple of days, which is a fantastic feeling and fantastic to see. And it's been some lovely comments about it and stuff. So, wicked. Well done, guys.
Yeah, it's been a great start to the year for us, just seeing all your pictures coming in of people who've been getting copies of our book that, of course, we did launch on Kickstarter over a year ago now. Obviously, there's been a lot of new listeners since then. A lot of people still messaging me going, can I get hold of it? I miss a Kickstarter. So keep listening. Hopefully, we'll have a way for a few extra people to get hold of the book in the next month or so after all the backers have them. So thanks again for your support on that, and what an incredible start to the year. Now, it does kind of feel like we haven't done this for a long time, probably because we haven't. We had a few Christmas specials, so that means we've pretty much got like a month's worth of news to catch up on that we'll get into in just a second. And we've kind of hit the ground running as well with an amazing guest for our first one of the new year. We're going to be getting the story of the new Atari 2600 Plus.
Yeah, this was a great interview because you know, Ben Jones is the creator of the Atari 2600 Plus, and he's so frank and talks about, you know, the kind of decisions that they made, the way that it was created. But also, he's a local lad from Nottingham as well, so we were getting on really well. And it's a really cool console. You've got one, haven't you?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are aware of this, and probably a lot of people even got them in their Christmas stockings a couple of weeks ago. This is, of course, the kind of reimagining of the Atari 2600. It is a modern console from Playon and New Atari, you could call them, which is basically a slightly smaller Atari 2600, if you look at it. It's basically an emulation box, isn't it? So it plays the original cartridges, which is kind of its selling point. And also we know that Atari are doing this this XP range, where they're releasing new games and kind of reissues for the original hardware. So basically, it is a way to play classic Atari 2600 games and the new titles using what closely resembles original hardware. And they were kind enough to send me one of these before Christmas. And I did a YouTube video on it as well, which if you haven't watched, I'll stick that in the episode description. But also, I mean, I thought, since I was chatting to their PR agency, Atari's, I said, any chance we can get someone from the team on just to kind of tell us a bit about this new system on the podcast. So they went straight to the top, and actually, yeah, like you said, Ravi, got us Ben Jones, who is the guy that made it. And it is interesting because I did a video on this, and I did point out, you know, a few things that I wasn't happy about the system, and, you know, a few other people have done that as well. And I thought, you know, I'd put a few of these points to Ben and a few of the criticisms, and you're right, he doesn't hold back. He's very forthright, isn't he, in just explaining why that happened and, you know, even some of the fixes they're going to be doing as well, and some of the updates that we can expect from the system, because it is firmware upgradable. So, you know, yeah, a lot of the points that we raise are going to be fixed in, I think an update came out for it yesterday, actually, at the time of recording, which I haven't tried yet. But it is interesting to see, because he was an Atari kid, wasn't he? He grew up playing it when he was little.
Yeah, he did. And when we first heard about it, we weren't really sure about it. We were like, oh, you know, a console that's gonna play the old cartridges and stuff. And we weren't really sure about the appeal. But yeah, it seems to be doing really well and, you know, quite popular as well.
Yeah, so we find out all about the making of it, kind of the history of, you know, the design of it, and basically giving it all of these modern conveniences that are in there as well, and how the community's influenced the 2600 Plus and kind of what it means to him to be part of, you know, Atari's legacy now as well. So if you got an Atari 2600 Plus for Christmas, or you're interested in one, or you just want to hear the story of kind of resurrecting the system, a really interesting guy. You're going to really enjoy our first guest of 2024, Ben Jones, creator of the Atari 2600 Plus, will be on the show in around half an hour from now. Now, let's not hang about then, because we have got a lot of stories to get through, pretty much a month's worth of news. We've kind of picked out some of the biggest ones from the last few weeks, including this story that I've seen absolutely everywhere. And I was watching Modern Vintage Gamer's brilliant video on this before Christmas. This is that there has been a secret hiding inside the PlayStation 1 game Alien Resurrection for the last 23 years.
Yeah, this is really cool. I've seen this doing the rounds, like you say, everywhere. So I think there was a few tricks with the PS1 to get it to play copied games. I had a chipped PS1 growing up.
Naughty boy.
Naughty. Which I'm not 100% sure what the actual process is there, but they called it chipped, and it was something to do with the laser. And then there was another way, which I know Ravi's familiar with, where
the swap trick, where you'd have to do it really fast.
Yeah, where you kind of like keep the lid open and stuff like that. But the reason this is kind of getting notoriety is that Argonaut Studios, who famously made Star Fox, then also made Alien Resurrection for the PS1 in the year 2000. And one of their main programmers, who is called Martin Piper, has come forward to say that there was a anti-piracy cheat code in there within the game, built within the game.
What it seemed to be was you say there was the mod chip, but then there was also the swap trick,
yeah,
which is another one. And of course, you needed the lid open.
Yeah,
people would jam a bit of paper in, or there'd be a bit of pencil. But this, to me, it's a code that acts as a boot disk, basically. But yeah, it's on a commercial release, which is absolutely mental that this got approval and that this went through. You know, giving you the ability to do CDRs in there. And I guess it was like something left from development when they were testing stuff. But to have a essentially a boot disk inside a commercial release for the PlayStation 1.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming you're spot on there. I don't think it was, I don't think it's a case of everybody knew it was on there, and then when it went to, whoever, I think 20th Century Fox or Sony, when, the publishers of the game, because it was obviously the Alien franchise, they probably didn't know it was in there. It was probably left in there, as you say, from testing when they were programming the game.
The reason was, if you watch Modern Vintage Gamer, he mentions it at the end, kind of why it's in there, because apparently okay. Alien Resurrection was, they were planning on it being a multi-disc game. So right. Basically there was some code in there, because, obviously when you open the PlayStation's lid, the console resets, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But they were working on some code to basically allow you to open it and then put the second disc of the game in without the system resetting. So they were testing that out. That's why that code's in there. So
yeah,
what it basically does is it allows you, you do have to keep the lid of the system open for this to work by jamming that bit of paper in as well, so it doesn't recognize it. But it does mean that what you can do is take the Alien Resurrection disc out, put this code in, which is basically kind of going around the D-pad a couple of times and then pressing the triangle and circle button, in succession.
Yeah.
And then you can put a burnt disc in and it will then boot that CDR. Yeah. So obviously it's a lot less stressful on the hardware than doing the swap trick that involves you kind of quickly pulling a disc off and putting another one on and swapping them back and forth. So this would have been a game changer if we knew about this back in the day.
Yeah.
And it was sitting there all that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I love. I love these things, and I love that people wait, to make sure they don't get into trouble. Like if we revealed this in like 2001, it probably would have been uproar, but it's like, 23 years later, 24 years later, people don't care now, which I think, is funny. But yeah, don't you have to hold some buttons as well when you actually boot the game up, the Alien Resurrection game up as well. You have to hold some of the L and R buttons.
Yeah, it's not easy to do by the looks of it. It's quite, I was going to mention how to do it, but
he does it on a PS1 as well, like ONE, the later, smaller ones. And I remember the swap trick was easier on the original PlayStations.
Oh, right.
And they're much harder. I don't know if they developed something in there to prevent people from doing it. But, I remember you had to be really fast to get it to work on the smaller PS, yeah.
Yeah, but if we knew about this back in the day, the mod chip market would have... this probably would have been the biggest selling PlayStation 1 game. would have been wonders for them, yeah. But they do mention that, this was basically that hidden code in there to maybe boot a second disc of the game that they didn't mention to Sony. Because as you said then, if Sony knew about it, they would not have let that go through.
I always wonder how many games have hidden codes in there that are still to be discovered.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because I know there was stuff like... I think there was an action replay for the PlayStation 1, wasn't that? I don't know how popular they were, but...
There were exploits that were done on the memory cards as well.
Yeah.
So
I know with action replays, I've never used a PlayStation 1 action replay, but I know on the Amiga, for example, you can kind of disassemble the code and kind of see how it works, which I imagine would make finding hidden codes like this easier in games with hardware like that. And today, obviously we've got all the ROM files and the ISOs are kind of dumped on the internet, so I imagine kind of going through them, even in something like a hex editor or something, is probably easier than it used to be. So, like you said, the fact that this has remained hidden in there, something that would have been such a big deal 23 years ago, it does make you excited to find out what else is kind of lurking in games that we haven't discovered yet. So obviously we'll keep you posted as we hear more, but yeah, very cool trick. And if you want to check out that video from Modern Vintage Gamer, I will put that in the show notes as well. Now, speaking of things that are kind of long lost, this is very cool. I must admit, this wasn't something I was even aware was a thing. I do remember back in the day watching Bad Influence on TV and seeing when Violet Berlin was in Japan and she went to Space World and she saw that kind of first preview the first public showing, wasn't it, of the Nintendo 64. And I remember watching that and being like, wow, you know, this system that had been hyped up for so long, and kind of seeing that Mario 64 demo on the screen. Also, there's Kirby's Air Ride as well, which obviously was never released on the N64, and that guy's in the end. But I do remember it being a very impressive demo of the system as well. But actually, it turns out there was something kind of hidden in there that we didn't see on UK TV, but there is a very brief glimpse of Mario 64 in its early stage that was going to be a multiplayer game with Luigi in there too.
I remember at school, there were so many rumors, like, if you get all 120 stars and then do, you know, 50 backflips and you can get on the roof, you find Luigi and Luigi becomes playable and the game becomes two-player. And it's really funny because it's like, there's all these rumors that, you know, were on the playground and stuff. And these went well on to, you know, into the 2000s, you know, people, you know, I remember at my school talking about them and stuff. And yeah, interestingly, it's now kind of coming out that, not in the final game, but obviously in the very, very early builds of the game, that, you know, this was, there was some truth behind it. So as you say, this is footage from Space World in 1995. And this has recently been uploaded onto a Now In Game YouTube channel, it's called. And it's from it's footage of a Japanese, like, news outlet variety show showing it off. So unfortunately, the footage isn't the clearest. It's a little bit blurry, and it's a camera filming a screen, you know,
from a distance.
From a distance, that's then been digitized. But in there, you do get a few seconds of footage. Like you say, not only Luigi playable, but also Luigi and Mario being played at the same time. So I guess in very early development of Mario 64, it was intended to be a simultaneous two-player co-op game with Mario and Luigi. But ultimately, obviously, we got no two-player and we got no Luigi in the original Mario 64. So, but I just found it really interesting that then became a rumor, you know, like, you know, that he was in there, like, buried in the game, etc. So I found that really, really interesting. There were some other differences, like the graphics are slightly different. The HUD design of the game is different. You know, there's some footage of Bowser where he looks slightly different. But yeah, the biggest thing is the glimpse. It is literally like a blink and you'll miss it. Luigi and Mario on screen.
Yeah, if you look, it's like literally you can see Mario on one screen. There's a monitor next to it with Luigi in it. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it's on screen for maybe a second.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's cool that someone spotted that.
Yeah.
No, I think in this footage and to see it. But what's interesting about that demo as well is, I mean, there are a few people who are saying the frame rate on it is actually better than the release version, which considering there was like two-player code in there as well. Yeah. The fact that it ran quicker with that seems a bit bizarre.
It probably wasn't running off the N64 hardware. It was probably running off, you know, the supercomputers.
Yeah, silicon graphics behind
silicon
the
graphics behind there. Yeah,
it'd be hard to hide a silicon graphics machine, wouldn't it?
Under a blanket.
Yeah, that's how they used to do it. Yeah, behind curtains and stuff, didn't they?
Yeah.
Could be a good point there, Joe. But it does make you think. I mean, you know, we mentioned about kind of that hidden code in Alien Resurrection. I wonder if that Luigi code is still buried in Mario 64 somewhere.
Maybe. I doubt it. You know, the amount of it's a Nintendo game. It's a popular Nintendo game. People have gone through that code, you know, with a fine tooth comb. Surely we would know by now. But, you know, there might be at Nintendo headquarters somewhere a very early build of that with Luigi in there still.
Yeah, because I know there was a few builds in the Giga League and stuff as well, but I don't think anyone's found that. You know, no. I imagine this is a very early build of it.
Yeah.
It does look very cool. It makes you wonder how it would have played as well. I can't get my head around being able to. I guess maybe it's if it was, you know, two players. How would that work with the cameras and stuff?
Well,
it's
like, that's the thing. So in the article I was reading, it did say, and you know, this is just, I don't think there's any truth in this. It's just speculation and rumors. But the Nintendo 64 DD, you know, the disc drive, did have limited online capability in Japan.
Yeah.
So they were saying perhaps it was going to be for that, and then you would play on separate N64s.
Oh, right. Interesting.
But that just feels so like, that feels so 2024 for 1996. Yeah. Feels so futuristic.
You know what? If they had released that, though, that probably would have been a system seller for it, wouldn't it? You know, for the DD and like online capabilities.
Yeah.
That could have meant we had online gaming like popular, you know, much earlier than it was.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah. you know, the DD never came out. It sold really poorly in Japan, and that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, how things could have been. So if you want to get a little glimpse of that early footage, you know, like you said, blinking, you'll miss it, but there is a little clip there of Luigi in Mario 64 buried in this 20-minute footage. It's interesting just to look at it as well, because, I mean, it's obviously all in Japanese, but I think just looking around the show as well, because, I mean, that was, you know, such a big event, wasn't it, back then when we got that first public glimpse at the N64, so it was worth watching. So if you want to check out that video, I will link that in our show notes as well. Now, of course, we do cover what's been happening in the world of Nintendo, Sega, consoles, Sony, all that kind of thing. We do cover computer news on the podcast as well, Ravi. You know, I mean, you like to get a bit nerdy about this kind of stuff, don't we? Including, yeah. I always love seeing this, something that adds a load of new functionality to the Commodore 64.
Well, this is like an all-in-one kit, and it's cheap and pretty amazing, the amount of stuff that you can do. So it's called the Teensy ROM, and it's basically based on a Teensy 4.1, which is a development board that runs off the ARM CPU.
It looks a bit like a Raspberry Pi Pico, doesn't it?
And it has obviously the CPU power in there, but it also has micro USB support as well. It's got, you know, you can put an SD card in there as well, but his board expands it. So this is a cartridge that's for the C64 and the 128 as well. And the amount of stuff you can do on it is absolutely mental. So it's got obviously super fast loading in there. It's going to load a lot faster than your cassette. It's got MIDI, and you can host MIDI, and it's got an interface for it as well. And it's got, you know, USB support in there, so you can have USB sticks, put files off the USB stick, load the ROMs in there.
That's very cool.
It looks really cool. And you know what I love about this? The price point as well. You know, it's $59 fully assembled.
That's really good.
Which is just mad considering what you're getting for that. And we've seen a lot of these kind of carts and cartridges and add-ons and stuff, and they have been quite pricey in the past. And kind of seeing this and seeing that this is open source as well really impresses me. And it comes from a guy called Travis Smith.
Yeah, no, you can get these. Like you said, I mean, he's uploaded the whole thing onto GitHub. So, you know, there's, you know, you can make your own. You know, there's instructions there with, he said actually minimal soldering. So apparently it's not that difficult to make. Or you can buy them fully assembled from him as well. A few things you mentioned there, which I think are awesome. The fact that, I mean, I've got stuff like an SD2 IEC, you know, to load off SD cards, which, you know, that they're very common for the Commodore 64. But I think, like you said, having this kind of all-in-one cartridge where you can load, you know, stuff like program files, or it even loads... it's got ROM emulation, so you can load like cartridge ROMs, the CRT files, they're called .CRT. So basically Commodore 64 cartridge games, you can load straight into memory from these too. Also, it's got internet connectivity, so you can
and a web browser as well, which is just absolutely mental to have that attached. It reminds me of something like, you know, the Vampire on the Amiga that did a lot of stuff, but obviously that had all the CPU stuff added in there as well. But just... The amount of connectivity and the amount of multifunctional things. I think these are going to sell really well.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously with the online connectivity, I mean, there's an Ethernet port on here, so you can connect to, I mean, you know, there is obviously web browsers you can get, very rudimentary ones. I think there's like a 64 version of Lynx, you know, the text-based browser. But what you really want to do with this is, I mean, obviously, first point is you can transfer files from your PC over your network to your 64, which is very cool. But browsing BBS's via Telnet. I mean, to me, that is like, you know, the thing that I'd use this for. Because I do have, like I said, I've got the SD card reader. I've also got a network card for my 64 as well. But these are kind of all separate devices. So having these all in one thing, I think is very cool.
And the MIDI is absolutely mental on there as well. So
I was going to talk about that next, yeah.
You can stream from your PC MIDI files directly to the SID. And that's pretty mad. And for musicians and stuff, that's going to be great for, you know, composing and having a setup with lots of different devices, synthesizers, stuff like this, and having your C64 acting as a MIDI device.
Yeah, I mean, you can even plug USB MIDI keyboards in and basically play the SID chip from a USB keyboard.
That's awesome, isn't
which,
it?
That opens up a whole new, you know, dimension there as well. And I think if you, obviously, you've kind of, I mean, you mainly do DJing with systems. I know you've got like an Atari ST in your Amiga DJ setup now. You could try a 64 for a bit. I mean, would this be something that might make you kind of think of, I mean, I imagine being able to play the SID chip over your Amiga sets.
I'd that'd just love to get into the whole world of MIDI, because once you get into that, you know, you can have all sorts of controllers and devices added to it, different machines, and you could add your C64 to this kind of network and get that beautiful SID sound.
Yeah, which, I mean, you know, the SIDs are like, you know, the gold standard for, like, you know, 8-bit music, aren't they? So really cool to see this expansion. I think, you know, even for me, I'm not a musician, but I think just having a cartridge with stuff like, you know, the SD card reader and USB support and an Ethernet adapter in there as well, all in one device, like you said, for $59, if you want to get it.
And I think it's, really, you know, it's going to get smaller, it's going to get more support faster because it's open source as well, which is a really cool thing.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at this already thinking it could replace a lot of my kind of aging devices now. So definitely tempted by this. If you want to get a hold of one, I'll link up the website. Looks like they're only available in America at the moment. So obviously you'll have to import them from Europe, or maybe there's, you know, it's a GitHub. Maybe someone's going to make them over here soon as well. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. If you want to check it out, I'll link that up in the show notes as well. Now, have you played your Super Nintendo lately, Joe?
I haven't. Unfortunately.
Oh, and playing with fire here.
I know. This has got me worried. This has. I need to fire it up. Sure.
Well, this is a bit of story. I mean, this is something that's kind of been known for a while. And I think we've kind of touched on it on the podcast before, that we know the Super Nintendo, the CPU in there has got Revision A and Revision B varieties. And I think it's generally been known that the Revision A systems are less reliable. But this has been something that's kind of been on social media quite a bit over the last month. And there's a few modders who kind of started this conversation. Also a retro repair specialist called Fenris Wolf Retro and a modder called Kona Kona, who basically started this conversation on Twitter/X, basically saying that, you know, they won't work on Revision A Super Nintendos because basically the CPU can die in them if you look at them the wrong way. And there's also been stories about, apparently people, I mean, if you check this thread, it's interesting, people saying that they've had their Revision A Super Nintendos basically in a cupboard for a couple of years and then taken them out and they've just completely died. The CPU's failed on them without them doing anything. So this has kind of sparked, you know, a bit of panic in the retro community. People thinking, you know, the Super Nintendos have basically got a ticking time bomb inside of them, which is pretty horrifying.
The thing that gets me about it and the worry of it is there's no, like, known prevention. It is just a case of it could just happen. And, you know, and I can't imagine it's a massive problem because people have only just started talking about it. And it's not quite as big as, like, you know, the batteries in the Game Boy games, you know, like the Pokemon games, which, you know, leaking everywhere or just dying and stuff like that. And it's not as common as that because we're only just starting to hear about it. But it does make me worry that in, like, you know, the next 5 or 10 years time, you know, SNESs are going to become, and they are already quite expensive. You know, you struggle to find a SNES for, you know, 50, 60 quid these days. They're, you know, kind of shooting up in price. But it just make me worry that in 5 years time, is the Super Nintendo going to be like a working Super Nintendo going to be like a really rare console? Like, and all of a sudden it turns out they've only got like the CPUs have only got like 30 years on them ish before they die. And it's just the early ones are dying now. You know, this is complete speculation and just my concerns and worries, but
it's amazing. Yeah. You know, all this stuff that we kind of collect and we all enjoy was never meant to last more than a few years. And I'm sat here with a 30-year-old machine next to me still going. And, you know, you're kind of plugging and patching and trying to keep it going. I hope ultimately that there'll be like a little clip on chip that you could kind of clip on top of it and it will bypass it. And then, you know, maybe an FPGA or something that would be a little replacement for it. But yeah, it's tough, but, you know, these things happen. I think, Dan, you just had your, 5-year-old television just completely go. And, you know, I've got a CRT here that's been running for years.
That is, because, I mean, they do say, you know, they don't make them like they used to. And I think that is true because, yeah, I mean, I had my 65-inch 4K, you know, HDR, all the works, you know, Sony telly that I bought when I moved in this house. So that would have been 2018. And that just completely died over Christmas. Originally, it wouldn't turn on.
I had a digital radio die over Christmas as well, actually. So, yeah.
I thought it might have been the power supply. I ordered one off eBay for like £6, tried swapping it over, didn't work. So in the end, I had to, you know, fork out for a new TV, which obviously in January, just after Christmas, and with my tax bill due end of the month. Great timing, Sony. But I mean, yeah, I mean, you're right, Ravi, completely what you said then, the fact that they make these devices to kind of... Because I did Google, didn't I? At the time, I sent it over to you guys the other day, like, what is the average lifespan of like a TV? And it was like, it said like 4 to 6 years. And I was like, you know, I said that to you, Ravi. I said, I've got two 30-year-old CRTs here that are still kicking just fine.
Yeah, and you know, Nintendo is not a company that I'd expect to have, you know, failures or necessarily use cheap components like a Commodore or a few others, you know.
Well, I mean, that is another system that kind of sprung to mind when they're talking about these CPU failures. I mean, you know, the Commodore Plus 4 and the Commodore 16 had like an infamously weak CPU in there in terms of reliability. It was, you know, I think Commodore had some new like kind of chip fab technology they were using at the time. They're kind of moving over to a new process, and they're like, you know, really, really unreliable. Again, you know, one of these where you're looking at it the wrong way and one day they just die. But luckily there have been people that have been kind of adapting standard 6502s to work in there, or 6510s, and people have been doing FPGA replacements for the CPUs in the Commodore Plus 4. So that does kind of fill me with confidence. Yeah, I think you're right, Ravi. There will be some solution for, like, you know, replacements in the future, I think, because these systems are so loved. I mean, they sold like, what, 50 million Super Nintendos? Yeah. I can't imagine the community are not going to take this seriously and come up with some alternative. But it does make me wonder how many, what's kind of the split with Revision A and Revision B systems?
Yeah, I guess... I mean, was there, I know we've spoke about this before, but was there an easy way of determining if one was Revision A or Revision B?
Yeah, I mean, it might be written on it if you open it up and have a look inside, maybe. Yeah.
I'm literally looking at mine now. You know, it's sat to the right of me, and I'm like, do you still work? Or have you just like, what revision are you? So I'm definitely going to test it out tonight.
You know, I've got systems like that where I think, if I don't turn it on, it works.
Yeah. In my head, it still works. Yeah, it's in perfectly good working order because I've not played it.
So, it might be worth just getting your SNES out over the next couple of weeks and giving it a try. And, you know, just not that there's much you can do about it at the moment if it does die, apart from, you know, get a bit depressed.
And if it does work, there's not a lot you can do about it because it might still die.
So these are the perils that we have, you know, being a retro gaming enthusiast. So it is good that people are making this a thing and, you know, bringing attention to this problem. So I think that is a way that people will find a solution to it, hopefully at some point. So fingers crossed, you know, not too many Super Nintendos die in 2024. Now, while we're talking about Nintendo, I thought this was quite interesting. Obviously, we think of the Game Boy, and we think, you know, what uses does that system have? Obviously, the main thing is we play video games on it back then, but actually it turns out that there are actually a few more uses to your humble Game Boy than you might think of.
The Game Boy has had, it's such a diverse, like, little, you know, handheld. So we already know, you know, it was used, it was compatible with certain sewing machines for designs and patterns that could be used. If I remember rightly, wasn't there a fishing sonar?
There was a little office suite as well.
The office
PDA
suite,
we talked about.
We've talked about that, but there was the official release for like the sonar fishing thing, I think. Mm. Hopefully I'm not making that up, but I can see that in my mind's eye.
I remember the sonar fishing, yeah.
And obviously, a games console, you know, a handheld games console, you could play games on it. But this is really interesting. It was used as part of the Peugeot, the car brand.
Peugeot.
Their Peugeot vehicle diagnostics in the early 2000s, which, you know, is doing the rounds at the moment. And maybe people, you know, maybe this is old news. Maybe people knew this because of, surely this must be something that was spoken about at some point. But yeah, it's been, you know, according to a Twitter/X user who is called X_Qtiv, so XXQtiv.
Oh, I still can't get used to that name, X.
has been talking about this and, you know, posted some pictures, but they were used to essentially use a kind of link cable to plug into mopeds, mopeds, and they would kind of run a diagnostics on there, such as like the engine speed, you know, how many volt, you know, battery volts, the engine temperature. And obviously it wouldn't just plug in. There was a cartridge that would come with it. And this was like a commercial kit that you could buy like as a mechanic.
The Peugeot Diag 200 kit, it's called.
Yeah. And you could buy it, and you could either buy it where it would just come with the cartridge and the cable, or you could buy it and it would come with a Game Boy Color, or in later revisions, a Game Boy Advance. And any normal Game Boy Advance or Game Boy Color was compatible with it, with the cartridge and the cable. It was just whether you had one at home already or whether you needed to buy one. And yeah, you would plug it in and it would tell you about, you know, what was wrong but give you some stats, and it would also give you some codes of what was, you know, going on with the moped and stuff. But I just think that's mind blowing that more people haven't spoke about it, or probably it's going to turn out now that there's loads of videos on it from like 10 years ago.
I find it kind of weird because in this article they're saying, you know, it kind of makes sense because, you know, the Game Boy had a screen and all of this,
yeah. PDA,
but you know, the Game Boy Advance was quite late, and so was the Game Boy Color. There were lots of other options for stuff like stuff that we've seen before has been, you know, the original Game Boy, which was out at a time when there were real, you know, there was a lack of decent LCD stuff. I find it amazing that this is kind of packaged, but also I've just got this image of someone at a pit stop, you know, in their Peugeot, and then a guy runs out with a Game Boy and plugs it in.
It does make me realise why sometimes mechanics take so long on repairs. And Tim, they just say, like, play Mario Kart on it, like, oh, I'll get to it later.
It could have been the case. Playing Pokemon, bit of Tetris.
In your spare time, and then some diagnostics. Yeah.
But I mean, apparently the reason this was kind of made was, you know, because, yes, there was, you know, Palm Pilots and stuff like that, and, you know, there was mobile phones and stuff, but generally the Game Boy Color and Advance were cheaper than them at that time. So that was kind of like the thought process behind it. And obviously, like you say, Ravi, they have the nice screen and stuff like that.
Well, we saw ages ago that a Gattridge was still using a C64 to do diagnostics. So, you know, there is a kind of weird relationship here with consoles and games and like old computers and fixing cars.
It does make sense as well. I mean, yeah, obviously it's commodity hardware. Like you said, Joe, they're a lot cheaper than dedicated solutions, I imagine. And because these devices were, you know, they're designed for kids to play on, so they're quite rugged as well, aren't they? So in like an environment like a garage, I imagine, you know, it's probably quite a reliable machine.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But it is quite, you know, it's quite quirky to see like like walking in the garage and seeing all the engineers around playing on what looks like playing on Game Boys.
Yeah, you can wipe it down with your greasy fingers, you know.
So. We need to figure out what's wrong with this moped. Quick, get the Game Boy SP out.
Finish Tetris, the next level, mate. So if you want to check out that little post on X, I shall link that up. And of course, all the rest of the stories that we talk about, you don't have to Google around. You find them every week in the show notes on your favourite podcast app, or head to our website at theretrohour.com. Now, we do have a patron for this podcast as well. A little reminder that we are, you know, we're obviously into the new year now. And hopefully you enjoyed the little bonus episode that we dropped last week. Because, I mean, we always take the week between Christmas and New Year off. That's kind of the one week. You know, we do 51 episodes a year. We take that week off. And we had a word to our patron community, didn't we, in Discord, Ravi? And I was chatting to them. We were like, well, should we put something out in that week? We weren't really sure what, just to kind of fill that gap. And a lot of people in there, like, why don't you put an After Hours episode out to everyone so they can kind of check out what they're missing if they're not a patron member?
Yeah, and I think that worked really well as well, because that gap's weird as well. I felt weird not doing the podcast every week. It's like, you know, such a integral part of our lives.
We did have a few people message Joe going, have you guys messed up and accidentally released the latest After Hours to everyone? It was intentional. It was an older episode from about a year ago. It was one where we got Joe on the Amiga 500 Mini. I put that one out to everyone.
So, God, you didn't tell me it was that one.
That was the one, Joe, yeah. We picked our favourite Amiga games, so definitely a good listen if you want to check that out. But if you want more of that, if you join us on Patreon as a gold member or above, you unlock, I think it's going to be 39 episodes of the After Hours podcast, some of which are like 2 hours long. So plenty of extra listening in January. And of course, with us just celebrating our 8th birthday, that does mean this month all the renewals are going to come out, you know, website renewal, audio hosting, all of that. So very good time if you want to support this podcast and make sure that we can continue throughout 2024. And also get an invite to the first patrons hangout of the new year that will be coming up at the end of the month as well, where we get all our patrons together. Everyone's invited. Come on, geek out with us for a couple of hours on a Sunday evening. So if you want to find out all about that and join our wonderful patrons community, all the details are on our website at theretrohour.com. And we did have a few new signups over Christmas as well. And of course, we do welcome in our new patrons into the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming. And that is the Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame.
And let's give a very warm welcome to our latest patrons, including Scott Coulter,
Hunt,
Frank,
and Ron Van Sherp, who all joined us on Patreon over the last couple of weeks. We massively appreciate your support. And if you'd like to join our wonderful patrons community, all the details to join us right now are on our website at theretrohour.com.
You're never going to let me re-record that intro. You're always going to use the old one.
Maybe we could open that up to, some kind of competition. I know, like, on there, if you listen to This Week in Retro, they have the Dave's Housekeeping jingle. Maybe our community can make it a Ravi Hall of Fame, or maybe not even with Ravi in it. It's like a Hall of Fame jingle. A little challenge that we put out there. If you fancy a little creative challenge in January, then please do get in touch. Now, before we get into our chat with this week's special guest, Ben Jones, telling us a story of the new Atari 2600 Plus, let's welcome on a brand new supporter of the Retro Hour podcast. And this is our wonderful friends at AG1. Now, I think this has come in at a very good time, because you might notice that Ravi is sounding rather chipper at the moment. And that's because, I mean, you know, you get to this time of year, weather's awful, and we're getting about, 6 hours of daylight here in the UK at the moment. And it's something that's actually become a big part of our routine over the last couple of weeks, and really made us change the way that we think about daily nutrition, is AG1.
Yeah, it's one of those times of year where we've ate too much and I'm kind of out of exercise and, I want to get a bit more focus, energy, and work on my immunity and health as well.
Yeah, now AG1, it's not just another supplement. What it is, it's actually a comprehensive and very convenient blend of over 70 high-quality ingredients. Now, the idea is it supports your mental and physical health. And the best part is it is so easy to make, isn't it? All you do in the morning, one scoop once a day into a glass of water, then just mix it up as well, and you get a powerful dose of vitamins, minerals, nutrients, everything you need to keep your energy up and your mind sharp on these dark, wet, wintry mornings. And I don't know about you guys, but you know, after having this, I've definitely noticed an improvement in my kind of my focus and my energy levels as well. Because I don't know if you guys are the same, but often when we get to this time of year, I don't know whether I've got that kind of SAD, but you know, with not having, maybe it's a vitamin D deficiency this time of year, my energy levels normally in winter are nowhere near what they are in the summer.
Well, I'm also not a master chef, you know. All my food doesn't contain the nutrition that I kind of need. So it's really good to have that.
And the good thing about it is, I mean, rather than having, like, you know, a black coffee or something that I often used to have in the morning to get me going, you don't get that caffeine crash as well. And obviously it gives you the immune health, you know. It's all going around again at the moment, isn't it? You know, everyone's sick right now. So it is packed with all the stuff you need, your vitamin Cs, zinc, other key nutrients to keep your immune system in top shape as well. So if you want to try this out, I mean, if you're wondering about the quality of it as well, this is actually NSF certified for sport, meaning it's gone through all the rigorous testings and verifications. So you can trust what you see on the label is exactly what you're getting. Nothing more and nothing less. So if you want something to help you out on, you know, these cold wintry mornings that we have here in the UK right now, and help your immune system out as well, something really convenient, why don't you give AG1 a try? And of course, you know, we always get you the best deals as well. So actually, as a bonus, just for Retro Hour listeners, if you go to this link, drinkag1.com/retrohour, that is drink, letter A, letter G, number one, .com/retrohour, you will get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. So head to that website right now, drinkag1.com/retrohour. I'll stick it in the show notes as well. And a massive thank you to our wonderful friends at AG1 for their support of the show. Right then, next, we are going to be joined by our first guest of 2024, and it is an incredible one as well. The creator of the brand new Atari 2600 Plus, Ben Jones, is next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest, and really excited to talk about this incredible new console that I did a YouTube video on last month. You may have actually found one in your Christmas stocking off Santa. Everyone's been really hyped about the brand new Atari 2600 Plus, the modern 21st century revisioning of the classic Atari console. So we thought, to find out a bit more about it, why don't we welcome on the creator of the new Atari 2600 Plus, who's also the commercial director of Retro at PlayOn, Ben Jones. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Very good, thank you. And thanks for taking a bit of time to come on the podcast. I know you're actually a local lad from Nottingham where we do the podcast. You and Ravi were doing a bit of a reminiscing about school rivalries and stuff before we started recording.
Yeah, I can't believe it.
I mean, kind of going back to your childhood, you know, apart from the school rivalries and everything in Nottingham in the 80s, how did like playing Atari 2600 when you were a kid kind of influence you? What kind of memories have you got? Have you got some like cozy memories of Atari when you were a little lad?
Yeah, definitely. We had one. So I was born in 78, so it was like a machine that had been out for a few years, but it was definitely one of the first machines that we had in the house. And yeah, obviously stuff like River Raid and all that. And then can you imagine in like your wildest dreams that like 40 years later, you're invited to make an updated version of it? It's kind of insane, really. But yeah, the wooden panel, everything about that generation. I was just more slightly going into 16-bit, I think. But yeah, I did, from a very early age, have these 8-bit machines, NES, 2600, and then quickly migrated up to SNES and Mega Drive when I think must have been a teenager then when they came out or a bit before then. But yeah, the Atari 2600 was a big thing. That joystick that used to kill our hands and the metal switches and all that and the clunk of the cartridge going in.
Yeah, I remember chewing on one of those joysticks as a baby.
Wow. Yeah.
What was your background in electronics then?
Well, about 17 years ago, I started to talk. I made a website in my bedroom where I was selling Nintendo video games. And it kind of like took off, and I was just buying stock from one distributor, and that was Koch Media. And you could be lucky, and you could just, you know, list on a marketplace, and somehow, you know, it took off. So I had a little bedroom one-man operation selling Nintendo games, and like I said, Koch was the distributor, and it did reasonably well. And I went down to meet them a couple of times, and it was funny, I kept on advising them to say, look, your website's broken here, here, and here. I think basically the boss just got irritated with me criticizing his website, and he said, well, why don't you come down here and fix it?
Right.
And he offered me a job. So I initially started just doing website management for them. They're a distribution company, so business to business selling, you know, all software for all modern platforms. But particularly at that point, they were a preferred distributor of Nintendo products. And it was, you know, the Wii and the DS heyday. So it was great to be around that. I've obviously been a Nintendo fan as well all my life. So it's great to get involved in there. And the journey into products, the journey to here, was basically that there was a competitor distributor that started to obviously be very successful with plastic tennis rackets and plastic baseball bats that you would attach to your Wii controller. You remember all that?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I think Virtua Tennis had one that came with it, yeah.
Absolutely. Just not worthwhile at all, really. I think, and my boss basically said, look, these guys are making loads of money. We're a preferred distributor of Nintendo. Let's get together, because he knew that I had a contact out in the Far East in Hong Kong. And I just hooked him up. I hooked up with him. I says, can you get me 1,000 cases for a Nintendo DS? He said, yes. Brought these cases over. And because we're obviously the official preferred distributor of Nintendo at the time, it was very easy to start bundling these kind of accessories together. So I started off with very simple things like plastic cases, like material cases, and then it morphed into these plastic tennis rackets and baseball bats, and it just kept growing and growing. And then I started to move into more complicated things, like I licensed the Doctor Who brand and made a Wii remote based on the Sonic screwdriver.
Oh, nice.
And that's one of my favorite ever pieces of work. So it's a great device. And so I just started to get more and more into that accessories side. And yeah, it just, you know, did licenses with like Peppa Pig and stuff like that, because they were, you know, remember the DS? It was insane how many licensed games were out there, and I could always make an accessory with the game and that. So that's where this kind of job came from, was that kind of area. And well, that all tanked when the Wii and DS went.
Mm. Had to look at the next thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I remember somebody saying, why don't you get into iPad and iPhone cases? And of course, like, because I just marched into the Wii and DS accessories market, I thought, yeah, well, that'd be easy. Just make some cases and that. But no, it's not the same. You need to ensure that you've got, like, your access to retail all sewn up. And then we were approached by a company called Retro Games Limited, and they were talking about bringing a Commodore 64 to market, a retro device. So
that mini console, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so they dreamt up the C64, and I was involved because of my links to China, and all my experience with logistics and all that. I helped them manufacture the C64, which was a real great success and a fantastic machine. Still see videos coming out of it now. And then they went on to continue releasing machines like the VIC-20, the big one with a working keyboard, and then they did a C64. People call it a Maxi in Europe, but we don't like the Maxi name, really, I don't think, in the UK. It has connotations.
Yeah, it's hard to shake that off, isn't it?
Yeah, but what else did they call it? I mean, the C64, I don't think it's got a suffix, actually.
Full size or something, I think I see.
Full size, yeah.
Could be it. But it sounds like, it sounds like, you know, that working on these products then, it definitely set you up for what you've done with, you know, Koch's is play on these days.
Yeah.
The company renamed itself a couple of years ago. So let's talk a bit about just getting into the 2600 Plus. Tell us how those initial discussions with Atari began, and how did you get involved in recreating something as iconic as the 2600?
How it started was that, if I remember correctly, I think I was introduced to maybe Wade Rosen by our CEO. So Wade Rosen is the current CEO of Atari, maybe somebody associated, I can't quite remember, but it was basically to do with selling the VCS in Europe. You know, the console that they made about 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, that modern console.
Steambox type thing.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about that for a while. Nothing really came of it. It just didn't make sense, I think, for us in the end. But I mean, like I was saying earlier, all these trinkets and all these things that I made earlier, I'm an ideas guy. So I'm always like thinking of products that could possibly be attractive to a consumer. And I did have an idea about a different Atari machine. But then one day it was a real clear in my mind. The guy at Atari just went, right, we've been talking for a long time, and to you, Ben, and we've also been talking a long time internally about bringing the Atari 2600 back. Holy moly. I was like, yeah. So I played it pretty cool, if I remember, on the call. But then when the call went down, I was like real punch in the air.
I bet.
I knew this was the one. I knew this was the one. Because the Atari 2600, apart from its incredible industrial design and aesthetics, it to me signifies the beginnings of home video interchangeable cart playback, really. But that one was the one, right? You know, licensed games and wonderful.
I was going to mention that, the licensing, you know, having the Atari brand and the actual, you know, original designs all available. How did that kind of help? And, you know, having the those kind of key principles, what drove the design on the Atari 2600?
That's a great question. I've been thinking about it a lot recently, and everyone always, I mean, the general sentiment is very positive about the hardware and the way it looks and that. And it's kind of funny, isn't it? Because all I got to do is copy the original. So everybody is very kind in that and says these nice things, but it's just an attention to detail to ensure that you mimic the original's look. I mean, there's obviously a slight change in size, but everything else, I mean, it's just look at the original machine, ensure that your CAD designer is putting it into a 3D model as perfectly as possible, then get 3D prints made, and then just keep reviewing, keep tweaking, make sure everything is, you know, like the amount of ribs that are on the front of the machine has to be the same as the original.
Yeah.
The amount of, like, the way that the metal levers look, they have ribs on it. They're really small, but...
And if you get that wrong, people will notice.
Yeah, it's such an iconic design, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just back and forth. But yeah, I mean, really just blessed with having that original design to just copy from, really.
Now, I'm interested, you mentioned about, you know, the fact that the 2600 Plus is smaller. It's about, I'd say, about 80% of the size of the original. Why did you decide to make it a bit smaller then? Was it purely just, you know, I imagine that the cost of shipping larger units in boxes, that kind of thing, if it didn't need to be any bigger?
I don't know. Sometimes things just happen. I mean, I had a couple of Atari 2600 originals sent over to me, and I always think, this is a chunky unit. This is big. I mean, you could kill somebody with those big old heavy sixes and that. And, of course, over the last few years, there's been a great... there's been loads of these mini machines coming out, but this isn't really a mini.
Mm.
I just said... I don't know exactly remember how it came about, but I just said to the CAD designer and the 3D printer, make one a little bit smaller. Let's see what it looks like. And they made one, and I sat it underneath my TV, and I just really liked it. I like the proportions. I like the way that the levers sit in that top faceplate. There isn't any spare. It's symmetrical. It's things like that. It just kind of looked right. I mean, there's slight savings on things like shipping and things like that. But one interesting thing about the 80% size, that it's actually the smallest it can be.
Mm.
Because if you go any smaller than 80%, the cartridge slot doesn't look... You have to mess around with the faceplate light scale. So yeah, you would start to lose that instant... It would look like a Uncanny Valley machine, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, no real reason apart from I thought it looked nice.
I was wondering what kind of like market research went into the audience for this, because, you know, it appeals to that older crowd, but also the new one. So who would you say is the kind of core audience for this console?
Oh, great question. You know, this market's very niche. So it's always only a few people that make these machines, and, you know, it's mostly engineers, and then there'll be somebody in licensing and things like that. And when we started, well, we'd already kind of done the deal with Atari, and then I got allocated a marketing team. So you have like shared resources in companies like this. So I'm just a one-man unit with a graphic designer. But we have sales teams, we have marketing teams, finance teams, and I kind of plug into each one in a certain way, and I got allocated a team of these the marketeers. About three of them worked on it. And the first thing he says is, yeah, we're going to get a marketing agency to do like some market research. And I was like, oh, what on earth? Okay. And I was pretty shocked at the price. But they basically came, they were to advise on exactly what you said, like target audience. And, you know, they did a bit of help with branding and things like that. And I mean, you know, if you want some bedtime reading, I think I could send it you. I think it was about 80 pages long. And it just talked about, let me think, it talked about things like Stranger Things influences and how retro has been building over the past 10 or 15 years. I mean, none of it was a big surprise, because you always think you kind of know it. But for somebody to write it in a report, it was like, it's kind of validation for the market. And the market, of course, that they instantly told me to go for was the 40 to 55 market. And then there's subsequent little segments. Like, there are young people that are interested in retro. I'm always quite surprised at it, that people choose certain generations of machines and go back, even like people in their 20s and that. So that was the kind of market research we did.
Did you know that there was going to be like a line of games coming out for it as well? Because when we first saw it, we thought maybe it was just for like the older titles or older collectors. But then obviously titles started coming out.
Yeah, the XP range, yeah.
From day one, mate. From day one. Exactly. They had the XP range that Atari have had the XP range, which they've been releasing games every quite prolifically, to be honest. And so that was a part of the thinking. And of course, we don't have any games preloaded on the machine. It was always to be a cartridge, a multi-cart. And then I just thought, or we thought, that we need a paddle set. Atari have got paddle games sitting there that we can utilize. And then I don't know whether it was somebody at Digital Eclipse, but somebody that Atari have got links with said that they had a enhanced version of Berserk. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting. Because reissues are great, you know, love them, but to give people a slight enhancement to it makes it, you're getting your reissue, but you're also getting it, you know, with a couple of quality of life improvements maybe, and Berserk was that. And then my favorite was Mr. Run and Jump. From the minute I seen it, I said to Atari, I really want to release this alongside the machine, because then we've got a nice selection. You got the 10 games, all varied, coming with the machine. You got four decent paddle games coming with the paddle set. Berserkers are kind of a reissue but enhanced, and then a brand new game. So it's a nice, compact selection. And I think there's a press release recently from Atari and Play On. There's four more new games coming. I don't think we've announced the titles, but that should be happening. And then behind the scenes, I mean, the response to the machine itself and it's just, we're honestly, people at Atari are absolutely fizzing, and here with me at PlayOn, absolutely fizzing with ideas what we can do and bring out cartridges next year. I think there'll certainly be a few more cartridges come out. What's nice about it is that if you get it right, it's a relatively low barrier to entry. Mm. Because the amount of cartridges that you need to sell is attainable, really. And be nice to have breakouts that go crazy. But just to give collectors and people that the opportunity to buy either reissues or enhanced editions. I mean, look at the homebrew scene of the 2607. They are insane games that people are making even today. So I'm sure there's talk about bringing them over for a more wider release. And then, of course, there's things like D-Makes, which I'm particularly interested at the minute. So that's taking a modern intellectual property and then making a 2600 game or a 7800 game from it.
I saw the Halo D-Make. Halo. Was impressive by Ed Fries, yeah.
Yeah. And that's really exciting because you have... Halo was a bit of a weird one because they went from like a 3D shooter to a 2D kind of thing. But there's nothing you can do. But that's the one that really excites me is to build games from the ground up using intellectual property. However, the only problem of that is that you're building something from the ground up with a reissue. Mm. Of course, you can dump a ROM on a cartridge. Bish bash bosh, you're out in a couple of weeks. Making Atari 2600 games particularly is quite a challenge. Mm-hmm. I remember playing Mr. Run Jump and I was like, I've got to speak to this guy. I've got to get who made this game? I want him to make me a game. And I said it to Atari and they contacted the guy. And as far as I recall, it was something like, the 2600 game, I had to code it in assembly. It almost broke me. It took me like 1,000 hours. Never again. I was like, okay.
So that's the thing, those limitations can make it more difficult, can't they? Because you've got to fit it within the constraints of the system and the RAM and the processor. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's no middleware tools and that for 2600 game making.
You know, I'm interested in, you know, when you're at that design concept stage, obviously you mentioned then that the idea was, you know, to make it cartridge only from the beginning, so, you know, it could play the original carts as well. Obviously, when you're designing a project like this, I guess there's always a danger that you'll get, I think, what's termed feature creep, you know, where you add too much into it. I mean, did you ever consider enabling it to play ROMs or having like a Wi-Fi chip and a store in there, or was it important that it was just a cartridge-based system?
Yeah, of course, we talk about those things all day long. I get a lot of flack. I'm on Atari Age at the minute, and I get a lot of flack for it not having CRT scanlines. I don't know whether you mentioned it in your unboxing. And I was like, oh my goodness. I went on a surreal like flight of fancy with one of them on Atari Age, and I said like something like, yeah, I just got a flux capacitor, and I went back to 1979, and, you know, I met up with David Crane, and I showed him what we were doing in 2023. And I said, yeah, we bought the Atari VCS back in 2023, and we play it on 75-inch flat-screen TVs. And then I was continued on this thing, and I said to David, I said, David, you know that, like, in 2023, people actually layer images of CRT scan lines over the top of a crisp image like that. And like I just said, and David said, why the hell would anybody want to do that? And that's my personal view. But I know it gives people that nostalgic hit. And I've written a couple of times that I'm going, you know, just because I have a personal view about something, it shouldn't preclude the machine giving people options that they want to have. And for sure, I mean, we've got quite a sizable update coming very soon, and I think a secondary update will probably be one that adds CRT filters. I've got to bow down to, of course, maybe save states and maybe a few other little quality of life things that people are used to, but I don't like it.
You know what it reminds me of? You know, when you get when CDs first took off, and then you'd occasionally get artists who'd put the vinyl crackle on the actual song on a CD.
Yeah.
Reminds me a bit of that, you know.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. That's a good analogy. But yeah, I mean, I think it's the way that I've got a problem with it was always with a menu. I like the cleanness of the Atari 2000. You're putting a game in, you know what game you're playing, you're just playing the game. That's the end of it. And my problem was always with like having a pause menu or something. It just kind of, for me, breaks that authenticity. But I have to think of a way of doing it, you know, that is tasteful and that is in a style of the 2600. But yeah, there's a few quality of life things that for certain I'm going to have to maybe a bit reluctantly bring into an update in the future for sure.
Well, it's great that you can kind of send updates nowadays as well. And I found it interesting that it's also compatible with the 7800 cartridges as well. And would there be any further plans for compatibility with anything else?
I never wanted to do the 7800 compatibility because it was really hard having two emulators running and trying to convince Atari not to do it for like weeks and months. It's too difficult. It's going to do this and that. But Atari just basically said, you got to do it. And we were going to come out earlier, but the development to get a 7800 compatibility was like put in and it came out a little bit later. I mean, the compatibility with the 7800 is obvious, right? Because the same cartridge shape.
Yeah.
Although it's got, I think, is it 12 more pins on either side of the PCB? So we had to adapt our cartridge socket halfway through development. Not a biggie. But, I mean, well, what other compatibility are we talking about? 5200?
Those carts are different, aren't they, as well? Yeah, physically, yeah.
I mean, maybe we could do, like, remember those, like, hooky cartridge adapters that you used to get for like Mega Drives and that, where you could put a Master System card stuff like that.
That'd be wonder. Cool.
I mean, it'd be something that I would for sure look into. But that one to me seems, basically, I've got more important things to make sure that we get right with the machine software right now than that.
Although having one system that could play all the, like, you know, the Atari 8-bit kind of systems ROM, you know, cartridges would be pretty cool, I think.
Yeah. I mean, we just got to see how it pans out, to be honest. We have to see how much legs the machine has next year. I'm pretty confident we'll be selling it for quite a while. This machine's not really got a time limit, has it? It's not got a technological,
barrier. Not going to be outdated next year. Yeah.
Exactly. the nostalgia piece will just keep giving. As long as we keep... So at first, we're going to give these updates. You know, make it best in class. Make sure nobody on Atari Age can moan about something that's wrong, a compatibility. And we are absolutely motoring through an update at the minute. You know, got 1080p coming, we've got 5060, regions like PAL and NTSC.
Yeah.
At the minute, the machine only outputs in 60 hertz, which causes a few little glitches, which of course people rightly flame me for. So that's already done. I've been testing it. And what else have we got? We've got a massive lot of updates to the 7800 gameplay, which will enable things like homebrew titles to work. And there was a bit of an unfortunate thing where there's quite a difference sometimes between PAL and NTSC 7800 games. So we got to I tested all 54 out of the 58 7800 games, but they're all NTSC. They all work perfectly. There's about 8 7800 PAL games that they just put together differently. So there's all things like that being fixed. Once you then have that, hopefully somewhat of a best in class platform, it will enable us to then think about games, all these things that we've began the conversation with, that were reissues, homebrews and that. And then I'd also consider, can we make a cartridge adapter to put 5200 games in? Maybe. So that's the kind of thing that we'll do, because the work on the software at the moment, although it's quite a lot, it's finite.
Yeah.
Once the machine is running, scrolling perfectly, whatever hertz, whatever resolution, no glitches, you're done. So it's nice for me to think, well, I'm going to be close to getting to that position. Imagine not having to update the machine anymore because you've basically kind of got it to a level where it should be.
Yeah. That's a dream, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure people will always find little oddments and that, bizarre carts that don't work. But it's had a good start. It needs to be great. And once it is, it opens up the thought processes to, I think just making games.
How would the updates work on it? Is that you put it on a USB stick and just put it in? Is that how that works?
No, it's not the most elegant at the moment, I must admit. You plug it into a PC. We're just putting together some instructions at the moment. And you use some kind of a flashing tool and we'll provide the image and it then flashes the memory on board.
Right.
It's quite quick. There's a little bit of setup, a couple of minutes, but then the actual flashing of the ROM is about not even a minute.
No soldering required, I guess.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's not as convenient as a Wi-Fi update or anything like that. But I think a lot of these people that want the update, they're tech heads anyway. So it will come to know. It won't be anything too strenuous for them to do an update. So,
You know, if we're talking about the kind of, the mod cons, the quality of life features that you mentioned there, for modern users, kind of, getting that balance right as well, the mixture between, obviously you need HDMI on there because, no one really has SCART or anything like that anymore, or RF, for example. How did you kind of get that balance then, and what kind of features did you think were important to include on the system? Which ones was there any you considered that you left out in the end?
Yeah, loads. I mean, I met with a guy at Atari every Monday for about a year, and that's what we would thrash out, exactly what we wanted in and what we wanted out. We're currently having a discussion with him at the minute about a wireless CX40.
Right.
I don't think some people are too keen on it. I'm very keen on it because I play it here using this wireless CX40, and it's such a joy not to have a cable, to be honest. And there was precedence because back in the day, there were CX40 joysticks that were wireless, albeit they had like a huge antennae coming out of them. So, everything was thought about really deep. It was just decision after decision and just thinking about it and reviewing it and going back to it. And yeah, a constant cycle. It was about 6 months part-time work, 6 months of very heavy full-time work and back and forward. So many decisions and that you have to make about the product that's what it takes. And then you get the final result. Yeah.
You know, the joystick itself, I think, you know, the recreation of that is really, really well done. And in my video, I actually opened it up and had a look inside at the board. And I know you've done some improvements on the original CX40 design as well, you know, making it actually better quality than the original, I'd say, by the looks of it.
Definitely.
How did you approach kind of recreating that then and getting that balance right? Because it does feel like the original, which I think is probably the most important thing, isn't it? If it felt totally different, then I think fans would complain.
Yeah, great one. I probably spent an equal amount of time or maybe even more time on the joystick than I did with the machine, because the joystick required really to be re-engineered due to the fact that just the way that the original was inside with those. I did actually, you know, there's like metal domes that they had instead of the elastomers back in the day.
And
a lot of the ones that I bought, the domes were flattened with use. And the way that the stick inside, you know, the main shaft, the way that the 2600 originally had a nice kind of mushy end to directional push, that's some really interesting plastic engineering, and where it kind of like, it has an extra O-ring that goes around it that you push into. It's not really natural because you can see that you're straining this O-ring, and you can see that, and there's lots of reports online that I read where, they just snapped. And I thought, well, we obviously can't have anything like that. We want the machine, you know, when we're building things like this, the fear of product returns from Amazon is the, and retailers in general is one of the biggest. So to ensure that the machine is as durable and the accessories, the joystick and the paddles are as durable as they possibly can be is really high, because every single return that you get from the likes of online retail and then bricks and mortar retail is a massive loss, because there's nothing you can do with returned electronic things like that, really. I mean, it's soul destroying, really, because when I've done previous reviews of returned units, I say like 100 units in the warehouse all returned, Ben. I say, all right, send them over. Let me have a look at them. 90% of them, absolutely nothing wrong with it. So, yeah.
That's just a user error then, was it, generally?
No, it's just very generous consumer protection laws.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, everybody being a consumer are very pro it, but when you're the manufacturer, you're like, God damn. Because what do you do with the machine? What would I do with the 2600 as a business? What would I do with the 2600 that's returned, even if it's in perfect condition? Yeah. Somebody's had their hands on it.
Yeah.
Somebody's like screwed it in and plugged things in. Nothing you can do with it. But back onto the question of durability and the joystick is, we really worked on that for a long time. I was constantly, at first, I got samples and that from the factory that was like, the 3D prints. And it was, you know, a lot of these CX40 joysticks you see nowadays that are sold, they're very like, like switchy feeling, like it's very definite. There's a hard stop. So it's quite nice to play games like Pac-Man with that. But I was just like, well, no, we're making the 2600. You know, even if people hated the CX-40 back in the day, I don't care. It needs to feel exactly the same. So it was always a case of, you know, revising the throw of the joystick. I used to call it the smushiness of the feel. There's a slight change to the feel of the button, but that's really was unavoidable. The original used like a spring mechanism, and I think it went onto one of those metal domes. And yeah, we're in 2023, the only way really for me to go was to use those elastomers. But even the elastomers, very deeply thought about. I'd always have lots of different, they all have like weights, like they're rated for like the pressure of when it's like activated, you know, the pop.
Yes.
And we always have lots of different weights of elastomers. And I carefully have to, I'm doing it now, I'm closing my eyes and you have to move the joystick around, press the button and just, no, I don't like that one. That's too poppy. And then that's light. I think we ended up on one of the lightest elastomers for the button, but actually for the joystick directional movement, it's quite a heavy elastomer pop. But funnily enough, it doesn't pop in your hands. It kind of just squishes.
And that's the thing, because to me, you know, having it side by side with the original, and I mentioned this about the switches on the device as well, on the console, I mean, they feel a bit like stiff to move some of them. But then I'm looking at my 2600 and I think, well, this thing's 40 years old. Maybe they were a bit stiffer 40 years ago.
No, they weren't.
Right, okay.
I can tell you about that.
Okay.
We got the levers on the right-hand side absolutely plumb. Perfect. Yeah. But the two on the left, I was never, ever, ever happy with them. And if you take the machine apart and you get the switch in your hand without the plastic that then goes into the metal lever and you switch it on and off, it's much easier. I think it's because we have maybe two or three pieces of plastic and, of course, the metal on the top. There's some kind of, like, I don't know what the word is. Is it like, there's some kind of, like, kinetic resistance. And because there's so many of these layers of plastic that just make it a bit too hard.
Right.
The factories looked for even lighter ones. And this is the lightest one you're going to get, Ben. So in the end, it's a bit too stiff, but it's not a breaker of anything. So I'll tell you one thing.
It might loosen up in time.
I don't think they will. I got a good one. Talking about the levers, I was actually going on annual leave at the point of the announce of the machine, and press were getting their machines and that, and the marketeers. I think it was at Gamescom this year. Yeah, it was at Gamescom. And we had our marketing and PR teams out there demoing it. And you know, when you get emails and that just your heart absolutely sinks. Mm. So basically, some of these, and they were pre-production, but they were basically production machines, were being tested by... were being demoed by the marketing department to press. And then I got this email from somebody in marketing. It says, yeah, I was just demoing this to one of the biggest journalists in Germany and the on-off switch broke in my fingers.
Oh, wow.
Like, oh, my God.
That's not what you want to hear.
I've just manufactured containers of this machine. And of course, I sit there all day switching things on and off, and they go through loads of testing. But sometimes you can miss something. Anyway, it was such a rapid redemption because I sent this fiery email off to the factory. I said, look at this, the bloody power button breaks when people just switching it off and on. As I was ranting on this email to them, and then in the morning they got back to me and they said, "Yeah, it's all right, Ben. It's all right. That switch was actually a pre-production one and it has like a hole in the middle. But on the production models, we filled the hole and it's made of a different plastic, which is stronger. So I went from like crisis going to bed to waking up in the morning with this email. It's like, oh, thank God, because they're the things that just kill you.
I bet that was a sleepless night. Yeah.
I can imagine away from the kind of hardware, you know, the emulation software was really important as well. And especially having stuff like no lag and stuff. I was wondering what it's based on.
Well, you got to go to the best. Yeah. You have to go to the best. The best is Stellar. And I actually contacted the Stellar team, I think about a day or two after Atari and PlayOn had agreed to go forward with it. So this was definitely a year ago, easy. And I said to them, and at that point, I didn't really have much of a clue of how I was going to make it. So I have access to developers of retro things, but, you know, this one I wasn't quite sure. So I contacted the Stellar team, and they were really interested, really, really kind, but they didn't want to do any work. There's like a hobby for them, and it's like there's quite a thing between the enthusiast crowd and then moving over to like a commercial proposition like that, isn't it? And some people aren't down with it, and some people are. And it was so funny though, because they didn't want to take a consultancy and do the work, but then would write me emails with all this fantastic detailed information. And I was like, well, this is insanely good what you were doing, just writing this to me. And I think, did I send them a very early PCB or schematics? And there's a guy called Thomas, and he's pretty much the apex of 2600 emulation, and he's the key member of Stellar. And he just basically railed against what was being suggested, again, like what the main chip was. There's two important chips with the 2600, the CPU, and there's also a cart dumping chip. And that's really important because the cart dumping chip takes the information from the cartridge and like puts it into a format that then can be read by the emulator, and then it plays. And like I was getting, obviously, from my colleagues at the factories, getting these suggestions of what we should use. And yes, Thomas like railing at me, do not do this. Don't have this chip. You need more power. And yeah, I took notice of everything that they said, to be honest with you. I had to redesign stuff on multiple occasions due to those guys' advice that they gave me. So although I never contracted work to them, they certainly gave me a lot of advice at the beginning. And also recently, since I've been coming a bit more active on Atari Age, there's so much information coming from them and the community also. So I had they were really key. And on the 7800 side, I just used an off-the-shelf emulator, didn't have any conversations with the developer. It was quite an old emulator and relatively stable. So that was it.
Yeah, in terms of you mentioning they're going on to Atari Age there and interacting directly with the community, have they influenced the development of the 2600 at all? I mean, you mentioned stuff like, you know, the CRT filters that are hopefully coming in an update. Anything else they've kind of given you input or feedback on that you've taken on board?
Well, it's difficult not to when you're reading them flaming you every day. Mm-hmm. But flaming me, I mean, there's a lot of nice, positive comment. Yeah, of course. I mean, one thing that's really interesting that's happening at the moment, I just keep looking at it and reading it and laughing, is that I set up I think we've got 100,000 views or something on the main Atari 2600 Plus channel. So I raided the samples cupboard, found, you know, one of them VIP kits, found a load of games, and I set up a competition on Atari Age. And I said, basically, I've got all this stuff and give it away because of all the views and that. It was like a celebration of 2 weeks of after launch and that. And I thought the only thing that I'm going to say is you enter this competition by posting a reply in this thread and telling me what game or games you'd like to see in the future. Again, it could be a reissue, could be a homebrew, could be a demake, could be anything. Well, these guys have been just posting all this fantastic suggestions. And I was saying it to Atari, this stuff's a gold mine. These people are suggesting things and giving us ideas that I never really thought about or didn't understand to the level of kind of excitement people have. And particularly, it's very interesting for me to see on this particular thread, maybe an even split or maybe a little bit more one way is a lot of people want reissues, yeah? A lot of people want, you know, Pac-Man again and that. But yeah. Then honestly, I think probably, and this may be, of course, to be expected with Atari Age, but maybe 50 to 60% of people just keep talking about homebrews and the new stuff. And I think primarily that's down to the quality of that homebrew. So, the community and that, it's a gold mine. I mean, just however we read everything. And, we form... You know, sometimes I disagree, like CRT filters, but sometimes, I mean,
you joke then about being flame, but it's just passion, isn't it? It's a passionate community.
And they've got strong opinions. They're so funny. Some of them are so blunt, and I'm like, Christ, you just to come in here blind. But like a lot of them, that's their humor. A lot of them, that's how they speak. And like, I saw it once when some guy was flaming a newbie and like, the newbie like just said something back to him, and the expert, he says, "Oh, sorry, oh, you're sorry, I didn't mean anything like that. just the way we talk." So
yeah,
I'm used to it.
I was wondering as well. You had a 10-in-1 cartridge that came bundled with the machine. What were the kind of choices of games, and how was that brought together? Was that done with you and Atari?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Atari sent me a big list of games. And I had a similar kind of thing when I was lucky enough to make the Capcom Home Arcade, where I had to choose 16 of Capcom's arcade classics to put on this machine. I was like, geez, this is a great job. And similar to that with the Atari, it was to think about a relatively diverse selection. Try and hit quite a few different types of games, and then also think about how big they were. So we knew we had to have Adventure. We knew we had to have Combat. We knew we had to have Yar's Revenge. We knew we had to have Missile Command. Maybe we should have had a couple of other bits that Atari had had. But then I just slowly... People at work are always very jealous of me because I'm often just sitting at my desk playing video games all day, and you can see them like giving me a snide look or something. And I say, I'm doing my research. I have to play Atari 2600 and 7800 games all day for weeks on end. Such a grind.
It's a hard life. Someone's got to do it.
Oh, dear. Yeah, it could be working down the pits, but I'm just playing video games. It's not too bad. So I would talk back to Atari. And then we would agree they would have their suggestions. One interesting limitation that I don't think anybody knows about with the 10-in-1 and the 4-in-1 is that people say, maybe something like, well, why didn't you put Centipede on it? I says, thing is here. Every game in the 10-in-1 had to be the same memory size. So you know those 2600 carts, they came in like 2K, 4K,
yeah.
Later on 8K, and even some 16s and 32s. Well, every one in the 10-in-1, it's either a 4K or a 2K, and then it's the same for the 4-in-1. So I had some limitations on the kind of selection I could have because they all had to be one certain kind of memory type.
Interesting. That makes sense, I suppose, when you think about it, yeah. So you're kind of limited by, they all had to be the same size, otherwise it wouldn't work.
Yeah, I'm battling with it for the minute because... Mm. I mean, obviously, we're talking about releasing new games and that, and I definitely need to find a way of having these different sized memory games on one cartridge. Mm. It's such a limitation.
Yeah.
If you're looking at like another list, you think, well, that can't go with that because it's a different. So, I mean, to me, it just seems relatively,
in my mind, straightforward to somebody can do something here. Just fake it and make them all 16 mega something. I don't know. 16K.
Don't use the extra space. Yeah.
There's loads of space on these things. 2K.
Yeah. That's 2K quite limiting.
For a game. I was looking at like photos now and it's like, wow, this photo I've just downloaded, 6 meg. Photo, a JPEG.
Yeah.
How many 2,600 games could I fit into this photo?
Well, Ben, it's been incredible hearing the story of the development of the 2600 Plus. And as I said, you know, as an owner of one of these fine machines, I think, you know, hats off to the work that you you and the rest of the team there have done. I mean, for you personally, you mentioned at the start that feeling of, you know, now having 40 years later actually worked on recreating this system. What does it mean to you personally then to be part of like the Atari 2600 legacy now? How does that feel?
Well, I think I said it to somebody else. It's just, you remember when I told you earlier that like Atari just said to me, "Yeah, we want you to make a 2600 be creation." I was like, throughout the development of the machine, I constantly remind myself that I'm a custodian of this recreation. And that's why, you know, when we talk about those metal levers, talk about the CX40 Plus joystick and things like that, always thought that I have to make sure that memory that people had of playing the machine is the same memory that they're going to have now. But now you got a nice 75-inch OLED to play those games on. And it was very important for me to basically not mess it up. Very important.
Well, as I said, I think you've done an incredible job, and the reaction I've seen so far from everyone else that's got hold of one so far has been very positive. So can't wait to see what you and the team do next and with these future updates as well. So thanks again for coming on, Ben, and best of luck with it.
Oh, thanks a lot. That's really, really kind of you. Cheers.